Hi, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, if you haven't been here before. We only have one case on our 130 docket. It's Harcom versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce counsel, who'll be arguing.
May I please report, Mr. Richard Mitchell will argue for the appellant. Ms. Megan Charlecott will argue for the state.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Mitchell.
Food for the state of Texas. Good afternoon. Your Honors, this case is about ineffective assistance. As the sun is shining outside, it is ineffective assistance. And even with the additional point you asked us to brief today, it is tainted with ineffective assistance. We have at issue a trial counsel where the appellant, Ms. Harcom, maintained her innocence from the get-go in this trial. Throughout the trial, and even after the trial, she maintained her innocence. And what happened? He failed to file a motion for new trial. He failed to file notice of appeal on her behalf. So even though I didn't brief it in my appellant brief, it is tainted this entire proceeding. So let's take the first point about the notice of appeal. Now, what happened in this case, Ms. Harcom filed a request to appeal, an application with the court for appellate counsel. There is only one reason why she filed a request for counsel, and that is for her appeal. Now, I'm asking the court to liberally view that. While it didn't say exactly, we can look at the clerk's record, it doesn't say exactly, I want to appeal. The district court in this county, when he gets this application for appointment of counsel, right after this person had a trial, was convicted, got the maximum amount of time as a sentence, he didn't go back and forth and ask, well, what do you need an attorney for? Okay, she had one case, it was disposed of. The district judge put appeal on there, and it was filed by her on time to the judge, and it was then filed in the district clerk's office on time. It was probably about 4 days prior to the expiration of the 30 days. So at that point in time, she was requesting assistance of counsel. We were asking that it show that it was appeal. The judge put on there twice, appeal in big bold letters, and then under order appointing counsel, it says on appeal. So we're asking that she did have adequate amount of time to file it, and she did file it. Now, while my filing came later, what was going on at that point in time, I know it's not in evidence, but at that point in time, I was in military duty. I didn't get this appointment until much later. I filed the notice appeal, and I put specifically on my notice, the notice of appeal, that she had asked for the appeal prior to the 30 days. I put in there specifically on there, if you look at the clerk's record, and the judge didn't say anything, and we had a motion for new trial on this case. So I believe, and the appellant believes, that we did meet the 30 days. Now, there's this one case that's a little bit similar to ours, and that's the Charles Brandon's unpublished case out of Amarillo. All I have is really the Westlaw citation, and that's 2005 Westlaw 884937. And basically, in this case, the appellant filed a notice with the judge himself, the trial court, and the trial court passed it on to the district clerk. Well, between the trial court and district clerk, a few days had passed, and it actually was filed after. So what this court said in Amarillo, it basically said, well, you filed it with the trial court. That's not correct according to the 25.2. It should have been filed with the trial court clerk. And if it probably would have had been filed with the trial court clerk first, it would have been fine. Or if and I'm kind of reading into it a little bit, if it had filed with the district court, then it would have been, and then he passed it on to the trial court clerk, district clerk, in time, it would have been, the Court of Appeals in Amarillo would have had jurisdiction. Okay. Now, moving on from there, for the ineffective assistance of counsel law, very quickly, it basically states that the trial counsel had to have been deficient in his performance, and that deficiency of performance would have had to have some effect on the trial. Now, when we first take the failure to get the witness. It has to be a reasonable probability that the result of the trial would have been different. A reasonable probability. And the appellant bears the burden of proving his claims by a preponderance of the evidence. Okay. So my first point was the failure to call a witness. To challenge the failure to call a witness, an applicant must show that the witness had been available to testify and his testimony would have been some benefit to the defense. Okay. Now, Mr. Trotta, the gentleman who testified in the motion for new trial, was available to testify. There's evidence that he lives in Walnut Springs. Walnut Springs is actually 30 minutes away from Granbury where this case was filed. He came on a subpoena that was delivered from me. The subpoena, went to the sheriff. He got it. He didn't even call. He just showed up because he was supposed to be there. He didn't call me. He just showed up because he was supposed to be there. He was absolutely available. There's evidence that Mr. Ottaway, the trial counsel, called him. Well, Mr. Ottaway said he called him, spoke to him. He was available. And what was he going to say? He was going to say that during the course of his employment of about 19 individuals, all 19 individuals had access to this car, and some of those 19 individuals had problems with methamphetamine. You would hear that from the driver of the car when she told the officers, listen, I don't want you to search because I don't know what's in there. I have coworkers that deal with meth, and I don't know what's going to be found in there. So I don't want you to search, and I don't want to be a part of this thing. So while that was in the video, I wasn't there for the trial. I don't know if that was played. There was a bunch of skipping around where the prosecutor skipped different portions of it. So we don't actually know if that was played. I know it was back there in the jury, so the jury probably could have played it. I don't know if they even played it. We don't know that. However, he would have said that if Mr. Ottaway had played that, it would have given more evidence that there was a lot of people who had access to this car. We have evidence that she was a passenger. It was the first time she was in this car, and she had no permission to drive it. She was getting a ride to get pizza. So in the span of this 30 to 15 minutes they were driving down this road, the meth and a pipe was found, but it could have been come from anywhere. Now,
excuse me, counsel, what did the record show, or was there some other testimony by someone else that this was a vehicle that was used by Mr. Trotter's business? Even though I know he didn't testify at trial, did someone else testify to that?
No, nobody testified to that. Again, that was on the video. but we don't know if it was shown. What Ms. Underhill was trying to explain to the officer was, the first thing when they got up there was, I don't have the information on me when the driver's license insurance. She didn't have a driver's license, but the driver's license was okay. But she didn't have the insurance and all the other information because she said, this is a company vehicle. So, and that's about it. So if that came out, because that would have been one of the first things that were played on the video, that might have come out. But there was no explanation of how many people actually was using this car. And that would have come from Mr. Charter because he would have known. Now, Ms. Underhill would know because she was an employee also. However, she wouldn't have the in-depth knowledge of who actually would use it. And that's that's powerful evidence. We have an employer who lets one of the employees use a car in the middle of the night on New Year's Eve. I mean, she wasn't doing employee-related stuff. So if he was letting her use his car at that point in time, I mean, we don't know where this car has been. And that's important. And while I'm going on that is that where was the drugs found? The drugs was found all the way in the back of this SUV. Okay. Now, it was of the officer's opinion that, you know, when he first went and he looked in the back, and he was walking while he was looking in the back, he didn't see anything. He talked to the driver, he talked to the passenger, brought the driver back, and he was talking to her in his car. Now, his opinion was like, oh, she was back in there, and the passenger or appellant threw the drugs back there. That was his opinion. Now, but when you look at the video, I mean, how was it? The drugs were actually found when another two officers came up and stood by the back window and kept looking and looking and looking. And you could, if you actually time it, you're actually 3 minutes into this looking in the back of this car, and I said, that looks like a meth pipe. And the first officer who found the meth pipe didn't even find the baggie. There was the other officer went around, looked, kept looking, used his flashlight, and then about half a minute later he said, oh, that looks like a baggie right there. And the first officer said, oh, good eye. That means the trooper looked at it. He probably was looking for something very obvious, a little meth pipe, a small baggie on cellophane, what was covered. If you look at the pictures that was admitted into evidence, the back of the thing was covered in cellophane, and you have a baggie with white stuff in it. He could have missed it, and that's important. It's important. I mean, the arguments that you could come up with, trial counsel could have come up with, and say, look how many people drove this car, look how many people had access to this car, look how many people, were involved in meth, and some of that would be relevant, and some of that would be able to come in during the trial court. That's her defense, and that's important, and he failed to do that. And it was so easy to call Mr. Trotter. The thing about his hard of hearing, I mean, that's the courts have the ability to put a device on him so he could hear. And I actually, all I had to do was go up to the counsel table, to the witness chair and talk to him, and he heard perfectly. No, way back there in Hood County where the council table was far from the witness, yeah, he had some problems, but all I had to do is go up and talk to him. So, and for the failing to object, I mean, this is a huge deal, the failing to object. There were pages upon pages upon pages about, and the state council did a very good job just going into, this is a lady who sells drugs. It's pure speculation because she has some drugs. She has her prescription drugs, I should say, in bags and in her in and some of them and in the containers they came into. She made a huge deal of it, just pages upon pages, and he didn't object to it at all. He didn't object one time, and then he didn't even request an instruction. I guess he said, well, it's in anyway, so why request an instruction? But the state of, with many pages, tried to prove that she sells a prescription drugs. And on the video, we have the two officers talking about it. He says, I think she sells prescription drugs. Well, the only way I guess we could really prove it is if we the driver confesses to buy prescription. That was all over the video. I mean, it is ridiculous to think that he would not say, flashing lights to say, that is a problem that the state is going to try to prove up that my client sells her prescription drugs. It was pure speculation. There is no other evidence than what they have. I see my time is up.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Ms. Califo?
May it please the court. Appellant Patricia Elizabeth Harcombe was convicted of possession of methamphetamine of less than 1 gram and sentenced to 24 months in the state jail facility on October 2nd, 2012. The Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure provide that a notice of appeal must be filed within 30 days of sentencing. And because appellant was sentenced on October 2nd, her notice of appeal was due on November 1st. Appellant did not file a motion for new trial or notice of appeal until November 8th, 2012, 1 week after the deadline. And as a result, appellant's motion for new trial and notice of appeal were untimely. In all fairness to Mr. Mitchell, the record shows that the order appointing him as appellate counsel was not signed until October 31st, 2012, giving him just 1 day to file his notice of appeal. But the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure provide a remedy for this type of situation. And those rules allow a party to request a motion or to file a motion for an extension of time within 15 days of the date the notice of appeal was due. In this case, appellant never filed a motion for extension of time in this Court of Appeals. A notice of appeal that complies with the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure is essential to vest this court with jurisdiction. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has expressly held that without a timely filed notice of appeal or motion for extension of time to file a notice of appeal, this court cannot exercise jurisdiction over an appeal. And the case that provides this holding is Olivo versus State. And the citation is 918 Southwest 2nd, 519, decided in 1996. And in that case, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals wrote, jurisdiction of a court must be legally invoked, and when not legally invoked, the power to act is as absent as if it did not exist. When a notice of appeal but no motion for extension of time is filed within the 15-day period, the Court of Appeals lacks jurisdiction to dispose of the purported appeal in any manner other than by dismissing it for lack of jurisdiction.
But as Mr. Mitchell noted, the pro se appellant at the time filed this motion to appoint counsel, and it was filed post-judgment, so why can't we deem that to be a sufficient NOA?
Well, if you look at the clerk's record, what the appellant filled out was an application for appointment of counsel, and there the appellant was only requesting that the court appoint her counsel. Nowhere in the body of this application does she give sufficient notice that she desires to appeal her conviction. And that is what is required under the Rules of Appellate Procedure. Only the untimely notice of appeal filed on November 8th by Mr. Mitchell gives this sufficient notice that Ms. Harcum, in fact, did desire to appeal her conviction. Only the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals may grant appellant an out-of-time appeal. Because appellant's notice of appeal and motion for new trial were untimely filed, and because she never filed a motion for extension of time to file her notice of appeal, this court should dismiss this appeal for want of jurisdiction. But to address the merits of appellant's claims on appeal regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, the law provides that to prevail on a claim of ineffective assistance, appellant must show two things. First, that trial counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. And second, that she was prejudiced in that there is a reasonable probability that but for trial counsel's errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. In reviewing these claims, scrutiny of trial counsel's performance must be highly deferential, and a defendant must overcome a strong presumption that the challenged action might be considered sound trial strategy under the circumstances. And a fair assessment of trial counsel's performance must make every effort to eliminate the distorting effects of hindsight and to evaluate counsel's performance from his perspective at the time. Moreover, to overcome the presumption of effective assistance of counsel, any allegation of ineffectiveness must be firmly founded in the record, and the record must affirmatively demonstrate the ineffectiveness. In this case, appellant argues that trial counsel was ineffective for several reasons. First, for not calling Mr. Richard Trotter as a witness. Second, for not objecting to the evidence that the officer found prescription pills and small plastic baggies in her purse. Third, for the way he conducted voir dire. And fourth, for the way he cross-examined the state's witnesses. First, in regards to trial counsel's decision not to call Mr. Trotter, the law provides that trial counsel has a duty to interview potential witnesses and to make an independent investigation of the facts of the case. The record in this case shows that trial counsel did in fact contact Mr. Trotter and investigated calling his employee and the driver of the vehicle, Ms. Julie Underhill, as a witness. Trial counsel testified that he did not believe Mr. Trotter would have made a good witness and noted his hearing problem. As Mr. Mitchell said, that when challenging an attorney's failure to call a particular witness, the defendant must show that this witness was available to testify and that this testimony would have been some benefit to the defense. But appellant has not shown how Mr. Trotter's testimony would have benefited her defense. Mr. Trotter testified at the hearing on the motion for new trial that other people had access to this vehicle, that Ms. Julie Underhill asked to borrow the vehicle at some point in time, and that he doesn't know what happened after Ms. Underhill borrowed this vehicle. Mr. Trotter could have offered no testimony regarding the circumstances of the traffic stop or the discovery of the methamphetamine in appellant's possession. And Mr. Trotter's testimony would have done little to explain how the baggie of methamphetamine and the methamphetamine pipe appeared in the back of the vehicle only after appellant was left alone inside the vehicle. Because appellant has not shown how Mr. Trotter's testimony would have benefited her defense, she has not shown how she was prejudiced by trial counsel's decision not to call him. In regards to trial counsel's decision not to object to the prescription pill evidence, the law provides that where the record is silent as to counsel's reasons for failing to object, the appellant fails to rebut the presumption that counsel acted reasonably. And that's exactly what this court held in Lopez versus State in 2002, which was affirmed by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 2003. And that's what we have in this case. The record gives no indication why trial counsel did not object to the prescription pill evidence. But given the deference that must be given to his decision, that decision was likely sound trial strategy. This evidence was admissible as same transaction contextual evidence. It was offered to explain why the officer went back to look inside the vehicle for a second time, which was when he discovered the baggie of methamphetamine and the methamphetamine pipe. It was only after the officer discovered these prescription pills and these small plastic baggies that he began to suspect that the appellant was in possession of illegal narcotics, and why he went back to look inside the vehicle to see if he could see anything else. This evidence also served as an affirmative link between appellant and the methamphetamine, because the same types of prescription pills, either alprazolam or Xanax, were found both in appellant's purse and in that bag in the back of the vehicle. Trial counsel also used this prescription pill evidence in his closing argument to criticize the state for not prosecuting appellant for the prescription pills, which was a misdemeanor offense, the state was trying to squeeze a felony offense out of a misdemeanor offense. Appellant has failed to meet her burden of ineffective assistance of counsel in regards to the prescription pill evidence. In regards to voir dire, the record is also insufficient to show that trial counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. And appellant even points this out in her brief. Trial counsel's strategy may have been to find jurors who had undergone a change of philosophy in their life, because he may have felt that these jurors might be more sympathetic to appellant's defense. Trial counsel's voir dire also located potential jurors who said they could not be fair. In this regard, trial counsel's voir dire was effective, and appellant has not shown how his voir dire fell below an objective standard of reasonableness or how it prejudiced her case. And finally, in regards to the cross-examination of the state's witnesses, the decision to cross-examine a witness is a matter of trial strategy. And in this case, trial counsel's cross-examination emphasized three key points. First, that the methamphetamine that was found was not in appellant's purse. That Julie Underhill, the driver of the vehicle, that her whereabouts were unknown at the time of trial. And three, that appellant's outstanding warrant was for a minor offense. An appellant also brought to light that there was no identifying information found in that black bag with the methamphetamine that connected appellant to the bag. There was no driver's license, no prescription pills with appellant's name. In sum, the record does not show that trial counsel's cross-examination was without a plausible basis, and she has not shown how his examination fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. I ask that this court dismiss appellant's appeal for want of jurisdiction, and in the alternative, affirm the decision of the trial court. And if there are no other questions from the court, I will yield the rest of my time.
I have a question. Ms. Califov, the page 15 of the state's brief. Towards the bottom of the page is talking about Trooper Neville's testimony. And his testimony, as quoted in the brief, was that he found two prescription pill bottles in the appellant's purse. and that one of the prescriptions was for oxycodone, and that the pills inside the bottle were prepackaged in little baggies, and this prescription was filled the day before the offense. And these, there were supposed to be, according to this prescription, 100 tablets inside the bottle. However, there were only 35 left. Now, that evidence by itself reflects that something happened to 65 pills between the time of the filling of the prescription and the time that they were found in the appellant's purse a day later in little baggies. Now, trial counsel's failure to ask questions about the prescription drugs could have been on the choice of trial counsel not to emphasize that aspect of the evidence.
Correct.
And it appears from the testimony at the motion for new trial that trial counsel's motive may have been attempting to obtain a feeling on the part of the trial court that there should be some lesser sentence given for the small amount of methamphetamine that was actually involved in the trial. Is a sentence of 24 months and $2,250, what is that? Where is that in the range of punishment possible for this kind of offense?
Well, this is a state jail felony offense, and 24 months in the state jail would be the maximum punishment.
And so in terms of what counsel was doing, in terms of looking at the issue of what evidence to emphasize by cross-examination, how was that question addressed in the appellant's brief? I didn't find that.
How was the punishment?
No, there wasn't a discussion that the motive of counsel might have been to try to do what counsel could in terms of not emphasizing that the part of the trial that involved
the oxycodone pills.
Packaging of the oxycodone in small packages, and that 65 out of 100 pills were gone one day after the appellant received the prescription.
And so, I'm sorry, I guess I'm not following
your
question.
I'm just trying to understand how that, why it's whenever trial counsel makes that kind of judgment and what and how to ask questions on cross-examination, that a proper motive might have been involved in terms of not emphasizing the fact that 65 out of 100 pills were missing.
Yes, I think that is proper trial strategy, not to emphasize that kind of evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Mitchell, rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. I don't know why do I have to file the extension of time when it is clear, if you liberally construe what you're supposed to do in the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, if you liberally pursue her you liberally construe her motion as a request to appeal. You don't have to file a motion for extra time on that. The trial court said, you're appealing, here's counsel. That gives the trial court enough notice, that gives the district clerk enough notice that she's trying to appeal it. My filing something, a formal notice of appeal, that's just something you file. You file a notice, you just file a notice of appeal when you get appointed to these cases. Let's talk about this real quick. When appellate counsel said, you have to limit the distorting effects of hindsight. The Court of Criminal Appeals has conceded that some errors are so egregious or outrageous they can't be the product of any reasonable trial strategy. I believe this entire trial was egregious and outrageous because it didn't make any sense.
Would you address what I just asked counsel about in terms of the evidence from Officer Neville that there were 35 out of 100 pills left in the side of a bottle for a prescription that the appellant had obtained the day before? And what happened? What's your analysis of that fact being in the evidence, but not emphasized by cross-examination of trial counsel.
I think it's a grave error to have the prosecution saying that your client is a drug dealing pill pusher. I mean, that is, I personally wouldn't do that. I don't know which attorney will. That makes no sense of trial strategy. Now, if in Crazy Town, I guess if that is trial strategy, your cross-examination will be, well, you don't know where these pills are. Does your grandmother have laid out in pills where Monday, Tuesday, Friday, Monday, the days of the week, and they put in the little pills, and you might have four left over? I mean, he didn't ask any questions on it. And it was emphasized because I think I counted them up. It was 10 pages. No, the entire trial was one volume. So 10 pages was the state prosecutor laying the foundation that she's a drug dealer in prescription drugs. And then for 20 minutes on the video, you have the officer trying to pull out every single piece of property from her big, it was a big purse, trying to find everything in this purse so you could lay it out to see what else is in there. And then we have in closing argument, she spent a lot of time on her drug dealing. So I don't know how you combat that if you just let that in. At least ask for instruction to say, and voir dire, you could even ask, say, get the jury ready to say, this is bad stuff that might come in. You could only use it for X, Y, and Z according to the law. He didn't even do that. And finally, you really got to look at the video because he didn't do a good job in laying out the facts himself. So what we have is the state facts. And if you look at the video, the trooper didn't go look into the purse, get probable cause, and go back into the car. That's not what happened. He looked in the purse because she was going to be arrested for the warrant. Now, he was finding all this stuff, wasn't charging her at that point in time. He didn't go back and say, I'm charging you now with possession of controlled substance under penalty group 3. He didn't say that. The other officers came and were just kind of looking around and said, oh, well, there's your meth pipe. That's when he said, and it's all audible on the video, he said, okay, that gives me cause to go into the car. So you got to remember that. That's important. Ladies and gentlemen, it's pure speculation on the prescription drugs. And one other important thing, when they were asking about the instructions, the prosecutor said, do you have the other bad acts? Is that in there? Talking about the charge, like the possession of other pills and all that. Judge, you're talking about the extraneous offense charge? Yes, with the misdemeanor pills. Court, do you want that? Talking to the defense attorney, do you want that in there? I don't. Even the prosecutor thinks it was a bad act. And the judge said, do you want that? No. That is not trial strategy. It is egregious. I mean, this is, and it was absolutely abysmal representation. I'm way out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel for their arguments today and your briefing. Your case is now submitted. Since we have no further cases for today, we will adjourn to court. Thank you.